Actually, let me type something for just 1 second.
No problem. Can you hear cat in the background?
Yes, I do, but that's okay. It's just it adds local color.
Exactly.
Thundar, the Barbarian. The year 1994. From out of space comes a runaway planet, hurtling between the Earth and the Moon, unleashing cosmic destruction. Man's civilization is cast in ruin. 2,000 years later, Earth is reborn. A strange new world rises from the old. A world of savagery, super science, and sorcery. But one man bursts his bonds to fight for justice. With his companions, Ookla the Mock and Princess Ariel, he pits his strength, his courage, and his fabulous sun sword against the forces of evil. He is Thundar, the Barbarian.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is Jacob Kurtzberg. Wait, you don't know who Jacob Kurtzberg is? Perhaps you know him better as Jack King Kirby. And you need lots of exclamation points when talking about Kirby. Kirby! And here to discuss it with me is John Queering. Welcome aboard the show, John.
Thanks a lot, Van.
John is a longtime friend and a longtime Jack Kirby fan. And I thought, John, that you would be the perfect person to talk about this topic, this great man, this artist and writer and editor to some degree and creator, this massive talent that we both are big fans of and always have been. And so I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
I certainly appreciate it. I'm happy to spread my love of Kirby, inundate the interwebs with my ramblings about it.
So. Absolutely. Well, that's what you're here to do. So let it fly. The first question that I generally tend to ask guests when we're talking about a specific topic is what first brought you to it? So, tell us what first made you. I'm sure you probably were reading some Kirby stuff, either art or writing or both, and didn't know it at first, because when we're all little kids, we don't at first, notice these things. But what first kind of made you aware of Kirby as an individual and made you kind of a fan?
I think actually it's fairly early on. I think the you may remember the pocketbooks reprints of early Marvel comics. They were the size of a regular paperback book, but they
and color.
Color reprints. I think it had to be probably the Fantastic Four, one of those. And there's also a Hulk one, both of those would have had Kirby art in it. I think really made me aware of the art. I was trying to figure out what the first Kirby I might have seen is, and it would probably either have to be a cover when he went back to Marvel, or it might have been a random issue of Marvel's Greatest Comics. I have a vague memory of a reprint of Fantastic Four 66, which I didn't know at the time, but that had which is the first part of the origin of him, or aka Adam Warlock.
Yes. And I'm going to touch on something about Warlock in just a minute. He's an exception to a rule I'm going to mention. But I was thinking about that myself. I think that probably the first time I had those too. I had the Spider-Man ones, which was like Ditko, but I might have seen Ditko doing Creeper before I read those little paperbacks, because I had some Creeper issues of, you know, when he was like the backup in Justice League or something. Anyway, but I definitely had the ones you're talking about, the Hulk, the Fantastic Four. I definitely remember that. But honestly, before even those, I think the first time I encountered Kirby was probably in an issue of Captain America, when he was writing and drawing Captain America around 1976, 77. This would be right after Mad Bomb, It Could Destroy the World.
Right, right. That'd be when he came back to Marvel.
Right. I believe the first issue I had, I always want to say like 214 or something. I remember the villain was the Night Flyer. And you know, this brings me to my first little theory, which is there are characters and particularly villains that only Jack Kirby could make seem really intimidating and cool. Anybody else doing the Night Flyer, he would be very lame. But Kirby made him big, in your face. He talked like a Kirby villain, which is he declaimed a lot, you know, lots of exclamation points. Everything is in your face. Everything is amped up past 11. You know, I would argue that Machine Man is the same way. When everybody else used Machine Man, he was that robot guy. But when Kirby did Machine Man, he was like the center of the universe. He was so, you know, important. It was all about his attitude, the way he talked, the things that he did. Kirby just brought, like, it almost was like it was an extra dimension to the page and an extra layer of energy. How do you see that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I just think that, yeah, when he was working on something, he put it all out there. He wasn't going to hold back, you know. He's going to let you see everything that's going on. And there could be some other context within some of these stories. I mean, I know that will probably surprise some people, but, you know, he was going to definitely, first of all, entertainment was job one.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. He was a showman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He wasn't just trying to render artistically what you might imagine in real life or something. He was doing help me out here. I want to say he was doing a Jerry Bruckheimer film almost with every issue of something. I'm not trying to say that as an insult or anything.
Right. No. I mean, I guess technically, you know, when you had people like, say, you know, currently like Brian Hitch or somebody like that, where they say, you know, it's widescreen comics or something like that.
Yeah.
He would have been like the Cinerama or, you know, one of the 3D at the time of comics, you know, like just the innovator.
Right. When others were drawing a person kind of looking like a person, he was drawing pictures that just seemed to reach out of the page and grab you by the throat. And that can be off-putting to some people. I mean, I think we need to mention up first and talk about this a little bit, that there, you know, a lot of Kirby's drawing style, and I think this is more and more as he went along, more into the 70s, people either love it or don't care for it.
That's true. I mean, he is one of, you know, that style can polarize a lot. It's one that, you know, there's other artists that are like that. I mean, you mentioned Ditko earlier, where, you know, I think at some points it's like, I don't want to see Ditko draw something, but Kirby was never that way for me, but I can understand that in a lot of people.
Yeah, it's got in a this is the thing that about Kirby, it's so hard to describe, because in some ways it's almost primitive, like Ditko in some ways was primitive, and in other ways it's incredibly sophisticated. You know, on the one hand, like his figures don't have a lot of nuance. They're powerful, but they don't have a lot of nuance. But on the other hand, the things he does stylistically with them were things nobody had ever done before when he started doing them.
Exactly. Well, he was, using the art to, all right, I want this action to be big, so therefore, here it is, you know.
Yeah.
In your face.
Really was in your face, yeah. And I know, I mean, when I was young, I guess, you know, if you start out reading like a George Perez and John Byrne type art in your comic, and then suddenly you read Kirby when you're, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, it kind of smacks you in the face. It's like you open the comic and a hand comes out and goes smack, right?
Exactly.
And you're like, whoa, what? This is different. Now, you first may say, well, this doesn't look like Perez or Byrne. I'm not sure I like this. But then again, you may look at it and go, whoa, this is amazing. You know, so, yeah, polarizing is a good way of putting it. I think people either are in abject awe of Kirby or they find it too much, maybe. Not what they, you know, not to their taste in a way. So, have you ever, before I get to that, I was going to say up front that John and I have both read and enjoyed Mark Evanier. How do you pronounce his last name? I'll just get it right.
I can't ever get it right either. I actually met him once, so that's even worse.
Yeah, well.
So we'll go with Evanier. For now. Okay. So,
called Kirby King of Comics, and it's this huge coffee table size hardcover book that came out probably, what, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find. There's so much cool stuff in it, I can't even find the title page. It came out from Abrams in 2008, apparently. I think it was delayed for a while.
Yeah, there was some publication issues because there was a potential that it was going to be two different books, okay. but it ended up just being the one.
But it's a humongous book with tons of color and black and white art all the way through it. And Evanier writes essentially what is a biography of Jack Kirby in between all the pictures. And so you really get his story from beginning to end, intermixed with giant full-page shots of Captain America or the Hulk or the Avengers, you know, or the Fantastic Four. That are these huge pages. And you also see some of his collages and some of his later work and everything. And so I just want to say up front, if you're interested in Jack Kirby, run out, and you can probably actually find it cheaper now that it's been out for a while. But unless it's rare, in which case the price may be going up again. I'm glad I got it. But it's called Kirby King of Comics by Mark Evanier. And you will not be, if you like Kirby at all, you will be delighted by this book. It also makes a good present. You'd think I'd get some money out of this for saying all this.
I know.
But I just can't recommend it highly enough. And so I'm going to be leafing through this. You may hear the fluttering of pages as we go along here today, because I want to flip through it randomly and find some cool stuff to talk about as we go. Now, while we're still talking about Kirby and kind of his style before we go into a little bit of his background, I believe that the book makes the point that Kirby, instead of drawing the way like every other artist in the world draws, Kirby would just visualize in his head the entire page, often like a double page spread, and then just start at one corner and work his way across. Have you heard that before?
I had heard that before, that he would start at a corner and just, you know, lay out the page that he already kind of knew. I mean, he would, you know, tweak things, but for the most part, he could lay out the page from what was in his head. He didn't spot check things.
That's just crazy. I just don't know how that's possible.
I don't either. Particularly when if you see some of the art, it's like, how did he do that?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, most artists, almost all, sort of build a page the way you'd build a skyscraper. They put down the skeleton, you know, and then they flesh it out slowly, and then they add things around it. So they're kind of working from the center out in some ways. So Kirby didn't have to build it. It's almost like Kirby just stuck up buildings prefabricated rather than building the inner structure and then adding the bricks and the roof and everything. He could just slap them down one after the other. It explains how he was so fast. Because he was very fast.
Right, right.
And the understanding I have is that one of the reasons he developed such speed was that, you know, when he started out years and years ago, basically how much money you made depended on how many pages you could crank out. And he was just trying to make a living for his family.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you think about his early Marvel period, how many comics was he drawing then?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, yeah, he and Stan, I mean, Stan was writing half the comics and
right.
Jack was drawing half the comics. It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, that gets us briefly. I want to talk about what his famous work ethic. Jack is famous for
He always just wanted to make a living. He just wanted to be paid adequately. He was never trying to get rich. He was never trying to be a big star. He was a very humble guy from everything I've read. He just wanted to be able to feed his family and have a reliable income to provide. You know, he just wanted to be a good provider.
Right.
And the way to do that in the early days, and we're talking pre-World War II, I think, to a degree, is to just crank out a whole lot of material because you were paid essentially by the page, you know. And he did that. And it as we go along through his biography and through his career, we'll see how that sort of work ethic is sort of at the center of driving everything that he does as he goes from company to company, always just trying to find the best deal that he can get, you know. And it's sad in a way because he should have been rich. He should have been a huge celebrity. You know, if he was still alive today, he would be the guest of honor at every big convention in the country and be given parades just about, you know. But alas, you know, he passed away probably right on the cusp of when that would have changed, would you say?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, you know, at least the potential for it to change, mm-hmm. you know.
So let's start back with his beginnings. He in the early days he was doing a lot of newspaper strips. What do you know about that, or what kind of comes to mind when you think about Kirby doing newspaper strips?
Well, I know, you know, at the time that was that would have been what would have been the big money thing, mm-hmm. was, you know, to try and get some sort of comic strip, you know. At the time we're talking like, you know, Flash, you know, Flash Gordon type things, Prince Valiant were all starting out then. So that would have been, you know, a primary artistic market as opposed to the fledgling comic book kind mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. I think not too long, you know, he pitched several ideas that never worked out, I know. And then I think he briefly worked in the animation business, where he kind of drew the art that happens between the frames, kind of to help visualize that for the animators.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's neat too. If you look through the Evanier book, they've actually got one page that has four completely different sort of daily black and white newspaper strips with sort of different style art on each one, totally different subject matter for each one, a different name on each one, and yet they were all done by Jack Kirby. There's Jack Curtis doing the Black Buccaneer. There's Bob Brown doing Cyclone Burke, like an air pilot type guy with fighting robots, apparently. That's cool. There's Ted Gray doing Abdul Jones, which is some sort of it would be seen as kind of racist today, I think. Arab thing. Almost looks like Tintin. And then Teddy, maybe he ran out of last name aliases and just went with Teddy, doing Sacco the Sea Dog, which is kind of I'm not quite sure how to describe that.
I think Sacco is kind of his Popeye kind of nod, I think.
Yeah, that looks right. And the idea is that because he could do so many, he had to use different names so that it wouldn't look to the public like the same guy was doing all their cartoons. I just think that's amazing. Just amazing. Okay, so he did these different, did the Blue Beetle, the Diary of Dr. Hayward, the Lone Rider. I mean, these all just sound like, Lance Kirby was one of the names he used there. You know, he was just doing all these just diverse things. I mean, he did things from romance to pirates to basically any genre you could think of in comics or comic strips. He was pretty much drawing and was that flexible at that early of an age. And then he meets up with Joe Simon. And
history is made.
History is made because what character is made?
Well, that would be the Captain America.
Yes, indeed. And what is Captain America's famous action he is taking on his very first cover?
Well, he's doing what we'd all like to do, is punch Hitler in the face.
Yeah. And not only does Jack Kirby have Captain America punching Hitler, but think about this. Jack Kirby was Jewish. So there's a whole lot of meaning kind of compressed into this picture. You have you have a Jewish American showing the symbol of America, Captain America, punching Hitler. You know, if we really wanted to psychoanalyze this, there's a whole lot we could go into about the idea of how maybe Jewish people looked at America as their defender, you know, the thing that would stand up to the anti-Semitic villain like Hitler.
You also could point out that that was before our entry into the war.
Oh yes, absolutely. And so, go ahead.
It was early 41, I think, when that came out. So
it's like a yearning in a way for America to step in and punch Hitler in the face. I don't guess the general public really knew about the Holocaust to any degree yet. I guess they just knew about his general anti-Semitism, right?
Right, right.
So just based on that alone, there would be a desire, maybe among many Jewish American people, to have America, you know, this symbol of America, Cap, take a stand against this sort of behavior and attitude. And certainly that would only increase as the war goes on, because I believe Jack goes off and fights in the war, doesn't he?
He does. He does. It plays into some stories that he writes much later in his career, too.
Yeah, it had an effect on him from everything I've read. So he's doing Captain America, but you may not realize, general public, that he was not yet working with Stan Lee. Stan Lee was like a gopher for Timely Comics or something at this point, right?
Yes.
He was fetching coffee for the boss and stuff like that. So Jack is fighting in the war, and he had been doing Captain America with Joe Simon, the writer. And Cap kind of literally goes on ice for a while. The character kind of disappears. And then Kirby comes back from war. And eventually and if I'm moving along too fast, feel free to interject anything that I'm leaving out that's important.
Well, I just want to, you were talking about it, to mention, go back to the work ethic you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
His, he and Joe Simon, actually, after creating Captain America, mm-hmm. they feel that Marvel is not, or Timely at the time, is not paying them enough, so they go to DC for a while and actually earn more money. So that would be the first instance of, you know, look, I need to get, you know, I want to be compensated properly for this work, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, and I think it's I like how you put that. I don't think there was ever a time, all the way till the end, I don't think there was ever a time that Kirby said, well, I'm making a lot of money, but I want to be even richer, so I'm going to go over here. In every case, it was that he felt he was not being treated fairly at all. Right? It was always him trying to get a square deal, not him trying to cash in big.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That was always the sense I got. Was that it was never him being greedy. And Lord knows he had a right to be greedy if he wanted to, because he created all his stuff and was pioneering an art form in a way. But it never was. It was never about getting rich for him. It was just that he said, you know, I'm doing A, B, and C, and therefore am earning X, Y, and Z, but you're only giving me X and Y. So maybe if I go over here, they'll give me X, Y, and Z, which I've earned.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, so he marries Roz Goldstein. That's just the greatest. I love that name. So Jack marries Roz, and they would be together all the way through till the end. And he legally changes his name to Jack Kirby. Wouldn't it have been cool if he legally changed his name to Jack King Kirby?
That would be awesome.
Jack K. period Kirby.
Yes. With the quotation mark.
And the quotation marks. Yes. And they just call him. He needed like a flunky that just followed him around all the time and said, "You got it, King. Whatever you say, King. You're the man, King." Kind of like Muhammad Ali. You know, yeah, champ.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so go ahead.
And now you mentioned he went to war. Yeah. I mean, and it wasn't, you know, there were several artists that went to war that worked on worked stateside. Kirby actually went. He was in Europe, I don't remember if he was also in North Africa, but I know he's he saw several battles in Europe during the final push and everything.
Yeah, it might have even been the Battle of the Bulge.
I think he might have been.
The time would have been ripe for that toward the end there, yeah. I mean, there's a fairly narrow window for, you know, Americans to be involved in Europe. It's pretty much got to be between June of 44 and May of 45. So it was only like 11 months. It's, people don't realize how short, you know, the post D-Day war was, I think. And so, yeah, he probably would have been involved in that.
He landed in Omaha and Normandy in August of 44. So
he didn't have to jump off the boat into the machine gun fire. Well, that was fortunate. We're all fortunate that worked out. Okay. So after the war, his daughter Susan is born. She's a baby boomer born right after the war, and he and Simon go to Harvey Comics.
Right.
Now, that's interesting to me. Those are the guys that gave or give us, like, Archie, right?
Right, yeah. Harvey had they would have been like Casper and things like that.
You know,
mostly what they would have been known for, would be known for later on.
Right. And they do a variety of stuff at Harvey. Boy Explorers Comics, you know, titles that could never make it today. Boy Explorers Comics. I don't even want to go there. I started thinking about it more and I thought, I don't think you need something called Boy Explorers Comics. Okay. Boys Ranch.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
They just really could not do these today. Stuntman. I like it. You think this is like starring Colt Seaver or whatever?
Right. Exactly. That's the only superhero I think that they did at the time, even. You know, that immediate post-war period.
And Captain 3D, but that's probably a little bit later in the 50s. And they did a few other small press sort of things. But they really got big on the romance comics in the post-war period. And
I think they essentially created the romance comics.
See, that's amazing to me. How many people would guess, knowing Kirby's style and the way he wrote and drew, who would ever guess, if you didn't know, that he was big on romance comics? But he would do whatever the business demanded. That was the thing.
Right.
He was so flexible.
Yeah, I mean, it was about, he wanted to tell a story. You know, at the time it was like, well, I can, you know, this looks like this will work out pretty good, you know.
Yeah. I'm just imagining that, see, people today, if you ask them, you told them Jack Kirby wrote or drew a romance comic, they'd imagine, okay, so Bob is in love with Sue, but Sue is in love with Galactus.
Right, and then, you know, there's a giant fight.
Yeah, exactly. Bob has to find the ultimate nullifier, and then, like, the Silver Surfer comes in, and there's Kirby dots everywhere, you know, and then the Black Panther shows up with some kind of weapon. And by the way, as we were talking about that, that's another character that only Kirby could do the way he did it. You know, in every other depiction of the Black Panther, he's like a lithe, slender daredevil type, right? Capital D, daredevil type. He's an athletic, acrobatic gymnast type figure, you know, whatever. When Kirby did the Black Panther, and I think Kirby co-created him, didn't he?
Yeah, because he first shows up in
Jungle. Fantastic Four, and then he got Jungle Action, which, again, things that couldn't happen today. Kirby made the Black Panther, again, it's just this over-the-top, in-your-face, larger-than-life. You know, Kirby's Black Panther is just different from everybody else's Black Panther. It was all about, like, the high technology of this jungle. See, this is the thing. Let me pause here and do a little interjection. This is the thing to me about Kirby when he was in creative control, as opposed to just drawing something for somebody else. And I want your reaction to this. To me, here's what Kirby would do. Kirby would think of some concept, or he would get interested in something in the news at that moment, and he would build some big, boisterous, larger-than-life character and situation out of whatever it was he happened to be interested in. So if he's interested in the idea of a primitive jungle people who suddenly have like futuristic weapons. There comes the whole Black Panther comic. It's not about him doing somersaults and punching a villain. It's about African jungle people having future weapons. If he's interested in ancient astronauts, like, you know, the Eric Von Daniken, the Aztecs had space gods and all that, then you get the Eternals and Icarus and all that, right? It's whatever he happened to be interested in at that moment, you get these big, he just blows a concept up out of it and usually does about 12 issues of it and then moves on, right? How does that strike you?
That sounds, you know, I can definitely see that. I would, you know, definitely concepts where he latches on to and says, okay, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and where it's he's found something in the culture that's really caught his attention.
Exactly.
And that's a little, you know.
Yeah. And he'd do it for about a year, and either it would get canceled or he would lose interest, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's on to the next thing that's gotten his attention.
Exactly. He's ready to keep going, you know.
If Kirby had been a novelist, he would be kind of like almost like Stephen King, where he'd have a different book every year, and each book would be about something completely different, but in that same kind of style. But
yeah, I think that's actually kind of an interesting comparison, because you consider how much, you know, people say, oh, King produces too fast, you know, Kirby draws too fast. Mm-hmm. That's impossibly appropriate comparison there.
Yeah, I think you'd have like a two shelves full of Kirby novels if he'd been a novelist at the typewriter. He'd have been typing as fast as Lester Dent doing, you know, Doc Savage novels 3 a month or something, you know, cranking out 100,000 words a month or some insane, you know, total.
Right.
That's what Kirby would have been doing. He's been working 18 hours a day at a typewriter in the basement, cranking out stacks of pages of pulp novels. And there'd be two shelves, three shelves full, and each one would be like, you know, little kids with dinosaurs. And the next novel would be, you know, Africans with high tech. And the next novel would be, you know, space gods in the Andes. And it'd just be one. And then, you know, like group of explorers who are all related to each other in a headquarters building in New York. You know, it would just be one after the other after the other. It's just amazing to think if he had been a novelist instead of an artist. But I think that's how it would have gone. Okay, so back to the romance.
Right.
He did it straight. There weren't like any, you know, Kevin Smith would make a joke here about, like I did a while ago, about how, you know, the Galactus shows up and eats the planet, and there went the romance, you know. Dick and Sue will never get together because their planet got eaten. But no, he played it straight. I mean, he was drawing drama and sort of not pathos, but bathos, I guess, as they say, you know, these schlocky sort of romance stories, totally straight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if he was doing something within like a genre like that, you know, he wouldn't just go, oh, well, I don't really like this genre, so I'll just throw in this. No, he would stick with it. You know, he would give you what you were paying him for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's that work ethic again. He was just determined to do what was expected of him by the boss. He was very respectful of the boss, whoever it was, until he decided the boss was not treating him right.
Yeah.
And then he'd just pack up and go somewhere else. So there's the post-Simon period in the 50s where they were not getting along as well. Money's kind of involved. Simon goes into the advertising industry so he could hang out with Don Draper, I guess.
Yeah.
Get the leftover women, get the hangers on, you know. So Kirby goes on and does some stuff for Timely.
Right. Goes Marvel again.
Mm-hmm. And he also does some stuff for the future DC.
Right.
So he really was working, you know, all over the place, wherever he could get work. The Challengers of the Unknown come around during this time.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's probably the big thing he would be known for at that time, really, is the Challengers.
And that's kind of in some ways a precursor to the Fantastic Four, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Yeah. He does some stuff for DC, like House of Mystery, World's Finest Adventure. He does Sky Masters of the Space Force. That's like the greatest name ever. it had Wally Wood was involved in that. And then eventually now we get to the Silver Age and Marvel. And, you know, it's amazing that during this time, as I said, he was just drawing all the time. You know, he would spend up to 14 hours a day drawing, producing 8 to 10 pages a day. Now, ask an artist today, if they could crank out 8 to 10 pages of artwork a day, what would they say?
Oh, no. Yeah, wouldn't happen.
Right.
Yeah. Couldn't happen, I don't think.
No, I think the artists today on average do well to do well about 20 a month, 30 a month maybe. Maybe 2 comics a month at most.
So yeah, your fast ones, I think you probably got 2 comics, you know.
Yeah, 2 a month. Yeah. And they're making a living, a pretty good living doing that. He's cranking out basically half of a comic book every day. That's just astonishing. So what does he end up doing first? I'm trying to figure out or remember what does he start out doing at Marvel? I guess Fantastic Four?
Right before that, he's doing, you know, like they've got their monster books and their little, you know, science fiction stories, the stuff that's in Strange Tales and, you know, Tales to Astonish and all that right before the superhero boom.
Let's pause here and address that. If you've ever wondered, people, why the comics that your favorite Marvel characters started out in had very un-superhero sounding names, John, kind of lay out what was going on with that you'd have like a Tales of Suspense with Iron Man or something. I mean, that never made any sense unless you know the history. So can you kind of address that briefly?
Well, a lot of it was that, they had, before the big superhero Silver Age boom, there was, you know, different anthology comics because they were trying to sell, you know, horror stories or science fiction stories were pretty big. Mm-hmm. And after the superheroes debuted, they had to have them in a particular title, but marketing or licensing or part of the distribution of comics wouldn't allow them to add new titles. Mm-hmm. So they kind of would have to stick them into some other title until, you know, as a trial kind of thing, or just, you know, use that in lieu of, you know, say Iron Man, you'd have him in Tales of Suspense or something like that for at least several years that they had to do that.
And that kind of goes on to kind of mess up the understanding that average people would have of how long or how many issues a certain character had, because you couldn't really say Hulk started in Hulk 1. You had to go back to Tales of Astonish, right? And, you know, instead of Iron Man 1, that was later on. You had to kind of go back to Tales of Suspense. So, like, all these comics, you know, the characters started out in books that were not named after them, and it was only later when what you were just talking about, the legal situation changed, or the distribution situation, whatever, and they were able to put more titles out suddenly. Then, in kind of a wave, they all got their own books, but they kept the numbering to some degree, right? In some of them.
Yes. Yeah, several of them, yeah. They just pick up the numbering from the previous book.
So there never was a 1960s Thor number one.
Exactly.
Right. But yet Thor had a high numbering simply because the book he was appearing in was an anthology book with a high numbering.
Exactly.
If that made any sense, then yeah, okay. It starts to get complicated in a minute. But yeah, I think people understand. Okay. All right. So now let's get him on to Marvel and let's get going here. He draws Fantastic Four number one with this young whippersnapper, Stan Lee. And what would you say he did in Fantastic Four number one? I mean, we look back at that comic now and it seems rather primitive, and I think that young people today would look at it and go, what's the big deal? Because of everything that's come since. But kind of lay out for the people that maybe don't know, what is it about Fantastic Four number one that makes it so special?
I think it's the fact that they've got characters that they're all on a team together, but they don't necessarily get along. And this is a pretty new concept, you know, that wait, one of them looks like a monster.
Mm-hmm.
so it's kind of completely against what you would see in, you know, particularly in, say, in DC, where, you know, you've got new characters, but you've got the Flash, or, you know, and Green Lantern, but, you know, they're nice guys. Superman, he's a nice guy. Surprisingly, at the time, you know, at the time, Batman, nice guy.
Yeah, he wasn't growling at everybody and being a general pain in the butt like he does now. He was, hi, I'm Batman. So,
right.
So the Thing really did make an impact, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it was pretty much like you took one of these monster characters from the books that he'd been doing, you know, a couple months ago, and suddenly he's now teamed up with, you know, some superheroes, mm-hmm. and fighting other monsters.
And the guy that is inside there is a good guy, if kind of a, you know, boisterous, belligerent kind of guy, but he's still lovable. Yeah, I mean, I think they really caught lightning in a bottle with Ben Grimm.
Right, yeah. I think, you know, I think in a lot of cases they kind of looked and said, hey, you know, later on they're talking about Spider-Man, where, you know, he's kind of like, oh, he's like, you know, what happens if a regular guy? But I think Ben Grimm really kind of starts a lot of that, where if you got turned into a big orange Rocky monster, you'd probably be a little, you know, grumpy too.
And he is grumpy. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's really fascinating that character. And I have to say, as a kid, I was not a huge fan of The Thing. He was just kind of one note to me, and because I think a lot of writers would be lazy with him, and just he's the wisecracking, annoyed at the Human Torch, and that's and then he'd punch somebody. They kind of whittled him down to just two or three notes, but he was much more layered and subtle than that originally, and has been since in some ways. But I have to say that, you know, years and years, I got my start writing, doing some fan fiction, some Marvel fan fiction for various websites before I kind of went off on my own. And I have to say, I started using The Thing a few times, and he's incredibly fun to write. He's one of those characters that you may not like as much to read, but writers just love having a character that can be such a foil for everybody else. It has something smart-alecky to say that poo-poos the brilliant idea of the brilliant, you know, teeth-gleaming, you know, leader. He's just a very useful character to have in a group situation, as kind of he kind of punctures the pomposity of everybody else.
I can see that, where that would be a fun thing to write, you know.
Yeah, he just is a useful character, especially in a team. And I think that's why he doesn't work as well solo. You know, his solo books have never done that well. He had Two in One for a while, but even then it was him and somebody else playing off of him.
Right. They were just saying, who can he team up with, you know, this month?
Who can he insult and grouch at this month and make fun of, right? So, yeah. What else did he do early on at Marvel that really kind of brought him to the attention of the industry and the readers?
Well, I think, of course he did the early issues of the Avengers, mm-hmm. but he introduced a lot of concepts in the Fantastic Four, of course.
Yeah.
And then in the Avengers, they bring back one of his original creations. So, you know, you get Captain America back. And I think a lot of that, you know, he drew a lot of those issues, early on, mm-hmm. when they brought Cap back. I'd say probably not at the time, but reflecting on what he will do later, I think Thor was actually pretty important for his later work, because mm-hmm. it gets a lot of concepts. It's his first dealing with some of these concepts, you know, of big, you know, cosmic type issues.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the whole idea of having like a pantheon of gods, of characters that he could use and he could shape that were bigger than life and that talked bigger than life. Man, when he started writing, he loved the characters that talked bigger than life. I don't think he had anybody, you know, speaking in a normal tone of voice ever when he was writing. And I'm looking forward to getting to where he kind of writes in a little while. But so, you know, he does the Hulk some, he does, you know, some Iron Man, but he was never really an Iron Man artist, in my opinion. That was never where his strength was. The original X-Men.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, true. There's so much, you know. It's like,
oh, yeah.
How can I mention everything?
Well, right. But, one of the most famous, I think, was Galactus and the Silver Surfer. And the story goes that Stan wrote this, you know, they didn't really use a script. The famous Marvel style is that the writer would do kind of a general outline of the story, and then the penciler would draw a story based loosely to some, well, not too loosely, but somewhat loosely on that story. And then the writer would go back and script over the existing art. And the advantage of that Marvel style of doing a comic was that it gave the artist more freedom and more input to decide how things should look. So rather than the writer deciding how pages should be laid out, the artist got to decide. And that's not a bad idea, and it was very effective at times for Marvel. But Kirby was sort of infamous for just doing, you know, going off the reservation immediately, right? And the story goes that when Stan decided he wanted the Fantastic Four around issue number 50 thereabouts to fight God. And so the Fantastic Four are going to fight a big, tall being with a G on his chest.
Right, because, you know, why not?
Well, if God was a supervillain, he'd have a big G on his chest, right?
Right.
For God. So so Stan gets the pages back to script, and what character has suddenly and inexplicably appeared?
There's this little guy on a surfboard, you know. Well, what's up with that?
And Stan is just like having a conniption. Who is this guy? But boy, does Stan come to like that guy, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He comes to decide he created that guy. I don't know how much we want to go into the Stan-Jack rivalry where, you know, I think it really is one of those things where you have that alchemy of two guys at the height of their creativity. And some of the things are entirely one and some are the other, but mostly it's kind of a mix. And so honestly, I would say in 90% of the cases, neither Stan nor Jack really should be able to say it was anything was all one or all the other. I think you really needed them both. Not all the time, but I think a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of, you know, give and take and all that, and I think that you could probably do a whole show in itself on just who did what and, you know, all that kind of thing, and, you know,
yeah,
that's a tangent that, yeah, would definitely take another hour or right. So probably.
Right. Well, some of the other characters he either creates, co-creates, or is involved in during that time, of course, Dr. Doom, The Watcher, Magneto, the Inhumans, the Black Panther, as we talked about. So there was a whole lot of great stuff. And in fact, I'm trying to think, was he involved in the original Captain Marvel, or was that after he?
I think that would have been after. Okay. I mean, I think the, you know, like the Kree would have already been in Fantastic Four at that point, but I don't think he was actually involved in anything with Marvel.
I think Marvel was like the last character Stan created back in that period, the last major Marvel character, and I use major in quotes, basically, with Marvel. I just couldn't remember if Kirby was involved. You know, one other thing we got to mention before we leave the first big Marvel period, though, is that so much of the foundation of the modern Marvel universe as it is emerged not just from Stan and Jack, but from those first 50 so issues of the Fantastic Four. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, I mean, you've got so much stuff in there. It's just hard to mention even a third of it.
Yeah,
that will later affect, you know, that will get used later on. You know,
like every issue or almost or every other issue, you get like another big foundation. So like I said, the Watcher, or the Kree, or the Skrulls. You know, or yeah, just Dr. Doom. Just one big thing after another every issue. If you were reading the Fantastic Four back in those early 60s, you know, you saw the Marvel Universe being formed out of the, you know, the ether before your very eyes every month. It's just amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah, just amazing. Okay, so in 1970, Kirby felt like he wasn't being treated well by Marvel. So what does he do?
Well, he, you know, decides maybe that other company, you know, DC will, you know, give him a little, make a nice deal for him. So I think he spends, I think it takes him a couple years to get all that contract negotiated out even. Mm. So I think it gets ironed out, and then he goes to DC in about 71, I think. Does that sound right?
Sounds right. Well, and here's the thing. Before we get on, you know, the thing that he's probably most remembered for, and there's several that have been brought back in recent years, but there's, I don't think there's any doubt, the thing he's most remembered for during that period is the New Gods.
Oh, yeah.
But before we get to that, I've got to point out, because Evanier talks about this in the book, and this blows my mind. DC brought him over, and they wanted him to do Superman. Now, Superman to me seems like a character that would totally fit Jack Kirby, because you got a big, muscular guy who is the epitome of the superhero. Just the, he is the stereotype of the superhero, Superman. And you could, you know, Kirby drawing him, you can just imagine half the page is a fist, and the other half of the page is a foreshortened Superman going off in the distance, right? I mean, Superman just seems like a character built for Jack Kirby to draw.
But, right.
But, and did you catch this when you read the book? DC was so, I mean, they brought him in to do it in part, to do Superman, but then they decided as he was drawing it that they didn't like their baby, right? Their icon, Superman, to look, especially in the face, like the definition of the Marvel look.
Oh no, yeah, any Kirby drawn Superman at that time, which, you know, he didn't end up doing the main Superman book, but there were appearances that he drew that had Superman. They would have someone else redraw the face and paste it over Kirby's.
Unbelievable.
Face.
Unbelievable. Yeah. To be more of like a Kurt Swan.
Yeah, yeah. I think
smoother.
You know, that, right. That looked, you know, that was out the less angled, less, you know, I guess.
Yeah. Because there was just such a perception that Kirby's style equaled Marvel. And so they had to get him, but once they got him, they almost were afraid to let him loose. It's just amazing to me. It's just amazing that you erase Jack Kirby's drawing and substitute it. You know, it's almost like if CNN brought somebody over from Fox, but then did a voiceover on the broadcast of somebody else. You know, it's just amazing to me. I just can't fathom. Well,
yeah, I don't.
Well, he does OMAC, which will later pop up again. Commandy, which will pop up again. The Demon. Tell me, do you know anything about Dingbats of Danger Street?
I do know about Dingbats of Danger Street. It was the DC at the time had this thing they called First Issue Special. They would try out. It was essentially a trial book, and that was sort of a new. And Kirby and Simon had done a bunch of kid gang books, you know, back in the 40s and even in the 50s, where, you know, it's just a bunch of, you know, teenagers hanging out kind of thing. And Dingbats of Danger Street, I think, was one more attempt to try that. This one, I think there's a little bit, and I'm just going to remember, I'm probably off on this, but that it might have been a little bit influenced by the fact that, you know, like, say, Welcome Back, Kotter or something, that some of the TV shows that were on at the time, that, you know, try and cash in a little bit of that.
Well, he also had, you know, I always think of Kirby when I think of like the Yancey Street crowd that Ben Grimm always has a dealing with.
Right, right.
Kirby just came out of that time and place, sort of that neighborhood New York City world where you had these little neighborhoods and little neighborhood gangs, and, you know, in the sense of more like kids hanging out as opposed to gangs like we'd think of them later. And so that was just such a seminal experience for him that he was always trying to do these youth gangs things in his comics. And I really think that as the years went by, nobody understood, nobody got it anymore. Nobody knew what he was talking about. It was just, it was a thing in American society that had kind of come and gone. And it just was something he was still trying to hang on to. And it just, I don't think it was really working anymore.
No, I think it was a point of reference that it's like, okay, I don't quite understand this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then of course we've got to talk briefly about the New Gods.
Sure.
What is it? What do the New Gods mean to you? What do you think of when you think about it?
Well, I mean, it's the epic. You know, I think this is what something that Kirby had been working toward for a while. To tell this big kind of cosmic story involving several titles. The main book was new gods that essentially told the main story of the fight between essentially, I guess, a good and evil, Orion and the people of New Genesis versus Darkseid and Apocalypse, you know, his homeworld of Apocalypse. You had Mr. Miracle. It was a little more that tied into a lot of the themes, but it was a little more of an adventure comic, and the Forever People, which was more like of a teen group, I guess almost X-Men like, I guess, of the New Gods. Essentially, they were the ones that were, you know, they're a little more to appeal to the kids kind of book, and then. But and then, of course, sort of related was the one mainstream DC book that he did work on, which was Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, which is what, the one where he ended up drawing Superman a fair amount. So,
and that was just weird because rather than being like the adventures of Jimmy Olsen, like snooping around and investigating, it was more like Jimmy Olsen gets turned into Plastic Man, or Jimmy Olsen gets turned into an alien, or it's just this. It was just these gonzo things, right?
Right, right. And then when Kirby comes in, I think he ends up on Jimmy Olsen because one of the, you know, he doesn't want to put anybody else out of work, you know. So he comes in and says, "Well, what do you got that doesn't have a regular team?" And they say, "Well, we got Jimmy Olsen." So, and then he introduces, you know, more gonzo concepts in that than, you know, most people would introduce in their entire career.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got things like, you know, I mean, at the time, the concept of DNA, you've got all these genetic, you know, scientists going around creating little tiny soldiers and, and weird monsters and clones and, you know, and who knew what that was in that time period? I mean, it's just, once again, this is what, you know, it's another, I just read about all this, you know, scientific advancement. Let me throw it in this Jimmy Olsen book and see what happens.
There you go. And there it is again, him getting interested in something that's going on in society or in science, whatever. And there it goes. Well, the last thing I want to ask you about New Gods, and we'll move on our last few minutes here, is because we've got to talk about his last few projects and everything, but the New Gods, it could have been forgotten. It could have been sort of off on its own little box, boxed up and put away in the warehouse. But instead, what has become the legacy of the New Gods?
Well, I think, you know, it ended up that particularly the bad guys, the main bad guy, Darkseid, becomes a character that DC can go to kind of to give them a big, you know, this guy, this guy's bad, you know. Yeah. We've got to have somebody that can take out Superman, that can take out, you know, the Justice League. So they kind of latch on to him later on to make him essentially one of their big bads.
Well, see, I love the idea that Marvel was doing stuff like that, and Kirby was a big part of it. But DC, because DC was always more compartmentalized, right? Marvel had the Marvel Universe. DC was very compartmentalized. Superman had Superman's book with Metropolis. Batman had Batman's book with Gotham City, and so on. And so you didn't really have a big sort of cross-company, cross-universe foe. You had Superman villains, Batman villains, whatever. And so what Kirby does is bring that Marvel element of a cross-universe, cross-company enemy that it takes everybody together to face. And so I almost feel like what the New Gods did was open a little hole in the DC universe, such as it was then, for a little of the beginnings of that Marvel style to creep in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can definitely see that. Because, I mean, yeah, the way DC worked and the way Marvel worked, I mean, even editorially, were completely different. So, yeah, once that door opens, it starts to, you know, you start seeing, and then the next group of creators starts to say, hey, why don't we do this?
Yeah. Well, we've already talked a little bit about his return to Marvel, 1976 to 78, where we talked about, you know, the Celestials you get with the Eternals, which they go on to be a big element of the Marvel Universe. The Eternals themselves kind of, not so much forgotten, but one or two of them maybe picked out. Cersei pops up here and there, you know, Icarus here and there. But really the Eternals are kind of shoved to like the D list. But the Celestials, now you had something on the level of Galactus, but kind of aloof, you know, not even more aloof than Galactus, if that's possible. Because Galactus is proactively out doing stuff all the time. The Celestials were almost more like this fate. They were faceless, this faceless presence in the universe. So he gave us that because he was interested, as like I said, in Eric von Daniken's ideas of the ancient astronauts and the space gods. So he gives us another round of that. He does a great adaptation of 2001: A Space Odyssey, which, you know, I think he was interested in not only for the science aspect, the mechanical aspect, but also sort of that cosmic ending and the idea of opening up to strange cosmic beings and forces from across the universe. That had to appeal to him. That was kind of his
thing. Oh yeah, definitely.
And I think in some ways his spiritual heir in this whole area we're talking about now is Jim Starlin. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, I think definitely you see some influence on Starlin, you know.
Mm-hmm. Devil Dinosaur, Machine Man. I read Machine Man number one when it came out, and I remember thinking, this is kind of a lame character, but the way Kirby's doing him, I'm interested. And I think that was probably the first time that what I said earlier occurred to me was with Machine Man number one. I remember reading it and thinking, this isn't that original of a story, but the way he's doing it is just mind-blowing. You know, it's a very small story in a way. Oh, a robot escapes and is running around the country doing stuff. That's kind of a cliche to a certain degree, even back then. And yet the way Kirby did it made it fresh and new and bold, you know.
Right. Presentation just really knocked it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Any thoughts about Devil Dinosaur? Does he hold a special place in your heart at all?
Well, you know, I don't know how you cannot love Devil Dinosaur. I mean, you've got a little, you know, cave, primitive caveman type moon boy, and he's got a, you know, big red T-Rex that he rides around and gets into trouble. You know, how can that not be awesome?
What kid wouldn't love that, right?
Exactly. Your own pet. I mean, tell me that, yeah.
Well, and he does Black Panther. He does a lot of covers, I remember, at that point, too.
Right, yeah, he's doing a lot of covers at that point.
Yeah, because he was still kind of the face. His art was the face of Marvel. Well, then, you know, he still's not happy, and he doesn't have, you know, benefits, which we all, you know, all of us older folks today can, over 15, can understand now, the whole need for, you know, health insurance, everything. He goes out, I guess, to California to get into the animation field, thinking maybe TV and movies is where it's at for him. And that's where we get Demon Dogs, Lord of Light.
That's right. Thundar the Barbarian.
Oh, my beloved Thundar the Barbarian. Because I got to put a plug in here, and it's not just me. There's like 12 people involved in this. But my buddies and I love Thundar so much, we did a book called Blackthorn Thunder on Mars. I even got the word thunder in there, and which is basically our little cross between Thundar the Barbarian and John Carter of Mars. So please go check that out. It's available. There's my plug. Because there's a lot of good stories by, you know, Bobby Nash, Sean Taylor, Mark Busquet, you know, lots of really neat stuff in there. James Palmer. I have a story in there too. Who would have thought? Yeah, imagine. But yeah, Thundar, he did a lot of the art design for that. I mean, he didn't do all of it. There are other elements too, but you can see a lot of Kirby in the Thundar the Barbarian stuff.
Right. Yeah. That of the stuff he worked on, that was definitely the one that, you know, it's like, oh, I can see some Kirby in that. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Absolutely. And that was a cool thing. He also, and you know, my all time favorite author is Roger Zelazny. And he was kind of involved in doing some art treatment for, Lord of Light, which was going to be like a movie and maybe even a theme park of all things based on Zelazny's famous novel about, a bunch of astronauts who basically pretend to be the Hindu gods to rule humanity. Yeah. And I could see where that would appeal to him because he'd get to draw Hindu gods.
Right. Yeah. And there's some nifty design art that, you know, from that is worth looking at, you know, particularly if you're a Zelazny fan, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just floating around out there. Some of it's in the Avanir book and it's around the internet and everything. It's totally awesome. Okay, so he also was involved in what we recently saw as Argo. What was his connection to Argo?
Well, the designs he did for the Lord of Light project were later picked up and used as the designs for the fake movie, the movie Argo itself, was those were Kirby designs that they don't really show them in the movie Argo, but the actual situation, the Canadian caper that the CIA was involved in, used Kirby designs as part of their pitch for their fake movie.
Now, see, I can just imagine the Iranian authorities being like, no, we're not going to let... Wait, Jack Kirby? Oh, yes, come on through. No problem. Yeah. Can we get the Ayatollah drawn with Kirby dots?
Yes.
Devouring like an American aircraft carrier or something. You know, that's what we want. Okay, so he does a bunch of stuff like that. And then in his last few years, he gets in with Pacific Comics, which had been kind of a distributor, but decides to start doing their own books. And this gives us one of my favorite Jack Kirby creations.
Would that be Captain Victory, Van?
And the Galactic Rangers, yes. I love Captain Victory. I love, because he put his most bombastic self. Every line of dialogue, every caption has at least two exclamation points. I mean, if he were to draw a scene of kids having breakfast with their mother in the middle of Captain Victory, it would be like, Junior, have some pancakes! Oh no, Mom, I'm full! You know, everything is just... I can't talk the rest of the show now. Hold on. Okay. Doing Kirby dialogue nearly destroyed my vocal cords.
Well, see, except you need to put two exclamation points at the end of that.
There you go.
Doing Kirby dialogue, did you try my voice?
Yeah, that ran for about 13 issues, more or less, and it was just total like retro Space Ranger fighting the Insectons, like alien insects, with the Lightning Lady as their leader and trying to devour the Earth. And, you know, there's just great scenes where like a Texas sheriff with the mirror sunglasses is being confronted by, you know, Captain Victory and these aliens. And he's like, now look here, boy, you know, you come down here on your flying saucer and try to boss us around, you know. Well, look here, sheriff, we're from, you know, the cosmos, and you know, just this dialogue that is just so over the top, but it's just so much fun. And it had the greatest cover blurb of all time in the big finale of their that first storyline. Do you remember what that was?
Well, I'm going to guess it's one of your favorite quotes. Yes. From it is the a good commander can beat the odds.
Yeah.
A great commander can beat the gods.
Oh, that is everything Jack Kirby I love in one little sentence. That is just genius. It's absolute brilliance. Everybody else is going, well, that was stupid. No, it's Jack Kirby and it's genius.
No, yeah. It's Kirby speak is just an art unto itself, I think.
Nobody else can quite do it. Now, I do want to mention, he did a couple others. He did for Pacific, did Silver Star, a couple other things. But I honestly, Captain Victory is just where it's at. If you can go back and I have it marked on Amazon that if they ever actually do the hardcover collection, I'm going to get it. But for some reason, they've never been able to get it out. It's on like permanent hold on Amazon. But I've got the somehow or other, I was able to get the electronic versions on my iPad. I just love having that entire series on my iPad. It looks so good. But I did want to mention that there's a, I don't know if it's still going on now, but I remember a couple of years ago, there was an artist who draws just like Jack Kirby. It's like one of those bands that sounds just like Led Zeppelin on purpose, you know, and does new material but it sounds just like Led Zeppelin. There was a series, is it Godland or something like that?
Yeah. I think I can try and pronounce this guy's name, but I will completely massacre it. But it's Tom Scioli or something like that. It's Scioli, I believe.
Yeah. And it's almost, I mean, it looks so 1960s, 70s Kirby that it's amazing. I think the one way that it goes wrong, in my opinion, and I've read like the first 8 or 10, I read like the first two trades, collections of it, trade paperback. The one way that it goes wrong, in my opinion, is that it doesn't take the material seriously enough. It tries to be cute. And that's the thing about Kirby is – it is absolutely gonzo, and yet you have to play it straight.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If you're doing it, you've got to go full throttle.
Yeah.
You can't just be like, oh look, my tongue's in my cheek on this. Right. So you know.
You can't turn it into the 1980 Flash Gordon movie. You've got to play it straight.
How awesome would the 1980 Flash Gordon movie have been if Jack Kirby had done it?
Oh man! Oh that! Oh my God!
Your brain just exploded, didn't
well,
it?
Well, but you know what? There's to some degree you could say that animated series that preceded it was very Kirby.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I don't think that he necessarily had anything to do with it, but it had a Kirby kind of a feel to it because it had dinosaurs running around and giant snakes, you know, and it had big, you know, spaceship battles and robots and all. I mean, if Kirby wasn't present physically, there was the spirit of Kirby way heavily behind that, which is an awesome series, by the way. And I think it's out on Netflix or DVD or something now, because somewhere or another I was able to watch it a few months ago again, and it holds up. I mean, you get tired of the same scenes. They'd use the same footage over and over, you know, for a weekly show, but it really does hold up otherwise. All right, so we finally lost Kirby in, I guess,
94.
It's hard to imagine that he lasted, that he was still around that late, because he really hadn't been doing any, you know, he should have been, he should have been guest of honor at Comic-Con. He may have been, for all, you know, he may very well have been, but he should have been every year, in my opinion. He should have been, you know, every year, the guest of honor, a huge celebration, but he just kind of died quietly in his home at the age of 76 in Thousand Oaks. And there have been a few things done with his work since then. I know that our buddy Kurt Busiek did a sort of a series based on some of his Pacific stuff, right? Did you read any of that?
I did not. It was based on a lot of the ideas from that he had published in Pacific, and then some that he had published in the Tops also. Yeah. In the early 90s.
Yeah. So you kind of had a return of Captain Victory and Silver Star and what was the Bombast or whatever from Tops. That's a good name for a Kirby character, Bombast.
There you go.
That should have been, yeah, everyone. But I guess really, you know, the last thing we need to look at as we close out here in our final minutes are just the legacy of Kirby. How would you sum up kind of and I know that's a big task, it's a big question, but take a shot. How would you sum up the enduring legacy of the King?
I think without Jack Kirby, there would pretty much be 90% of comics as we know it would not exist.
Yeah.
Is that, I'm probably overstating some, but you know, I don't think by too much anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in what concrete ways today do you kind of see Kirby's legacy? I guess.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, you think about, I mean, what was the biggest movie last year? Avengers. Mm-hmm. Was.
Oh, yeah.
How many Kirby character or co-creations are in that?
Oh, yeah.
Five, six at least.
And the story itself, you know, because it was still the Loki gets the team together by accident sort of origin type thing.
Right. And I don't think it's just in creators. I think in you know, the art form as a whole, I think it's influenced by, you know, a lot of his design decisions, his artistic decisions, you know, the way the action scene works in a lot of comics is based on, wow, this the way Kirby drew this is just perfect. So let's, you know, he got the idea of that action scene, just nailed it. So mm-hmm. Let's just take off on that. Mm-hmm. And of course, Kirby dots. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Where would we be without Kirby dots?
No, I wouldn't want to face life without Kirby dots.
No.
You know, and I think it's interesting that two of the big movies of last year, the biggest money-making movie, and didn't Argo come out last year?
Yeah.
The Academy Award winner. Both had kind of a Kirby element to them. That's really amazing. It was a good year for Jack Kirby, even if nobody noticed it, really.
Right.
You know, two big successes. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I also, like I say, I want to put in one more plug for his writing, because his art hits you in the face, punches you. His art slaps you around and calls you names as it forces itself upon you, and you like it generally. But his writing kind of does the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think it does kind of, you know, because of all the the over-dramatic dialogue, it kind of gets pushed. He kind of gets stereotyped as well. He wasn't, you know, mm-hmm. he wasn't that great a writer, but there's some stuff in there. I mean, we mentioned early on about as the effect World War II had on him. There's some stuff in his New Gods, and in he did a war book for DC for a while, for a very short period, called The Losers. That was about a group of soldiers that was very influenced by the action he'd seen during the war. That I think it's worth looking at in a lot of cases. I mean, you know, it definitely shows that, hey, that whole war thing, that's not really that awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is...
Well, and I think that his writing fit his art. And
oh, yeah.
Other people writing for him, I mean, Stan Lee early on, it was suited to it as well. But and that's kind of what I think is the lasting thing that people remember, is that early, that stuff from the 60s in particular will always, you know, endure. It's the foundation. It's the first several floors of the Marvel universe, you know, the foundation. But I just love his later writing too, because I just think it's so much fun, and it's suited to his art. So I would just sum up, I think he was an innovator, an amazing talent, a natural talent, a humble guy, just wanted to take care of his family, but in the process, he gave us stuff that has shaped a lot of the pop culture world around us, not just in comics, and that I think will really live on forever. And I think his reputation only grows every year, and he'll never be forgotten. So,
oh no, I think you're right. And I mean, right now, I mean, there is a ton of Kirby that's actually available in hardcovers, in trade paperbacks. I mean, I'll have to say that, I mean, various companies have, I mean, Marvel, DC, but even others have done a good job of putting it out there, so you can see,
yeah,
you know, the breadth of his career, essentially, you know.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. All right. Well, I think that we have given him a fair, I mean, we could go on for two or three more hours easily.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
But we've given a nice kind of overview, I think. And so I think people ought to just now run out, if they haven't got it already, and pick up a bunch of this stuff in the trades and everything. And they will certainly see what we mean. And I think the bigger the format, the better. You know, he was drawing on these big Bristol boards, and it gets shrunk down. It loses a lot of that power. But just imagine these things at like 11 by 17 or something. It must be, you know, mind-blowing. Again, I can't recommend enough the Mark Evanier book, Kirby King of Comics. If you can get a hold of that, you will not be sorry. You will not be disappointed. All right, John. Well, thank you so much for coming on board the Rocket today. It's time. Our time is up, and as always, we thank you for yours.
I enjoyed it a great deal. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. And as always, we will get the rocket on out of here, and we will see you all down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.